The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Joe Hill, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Hill is author of comic books, short story collections, and the best-selling novels, The Heart-Shaped Box, Horns, and Nosferatu. His latest, The Fireman, begins with the world as we know it ending. A mysterious pandemic is spreading like wildfire. Cities are smoldering, corpses litter the streets, the sky is choked with smoke. Even online, a Google search turns up a digital image of a smoking pile of ash. Hill's chilling vision of the apocalypse is set in New Hampshire, where signs of infection, gold and black markings filigreed over the skin, separate the infected from marauding gangs who shoot them on sight. Joe Hill stepped onto the stage of the Music Hall to introduce the plucky school nurse at the center of the novel, along with the community where she found refuge, at least for a short time.
All right, let's have a bit of the story. An incurable spore called dragon scale has raced through the nation, an unlikely infection that kills by spontaneous combustion. As the plague takes hold, hospitals burn and neighborhoods go up in smoke. The charred dead are everywhere. Infected and pregnant, Nurse Harper Willows has found refuge in Camp Wyndham, where a small community of the contaminated have learned how to suppress the disease. When they all sing together, or share in some other happy group experience, the dragon scale on their bodies lights up, glows like fluorescent paint, and delivers a sort of natural high. No one in this place of shelter burns to death. But in the darkest days of February, Wyndham has become a grim, toxic place. The elected head of camp, Mother Carol, is increasingly paranoid, haunted by threats real and imaginary. She has even come to fear John Rookwood, the fireman, an almost legendary hero to the ill. Those who cross Mother Carol are pressured to carry a stone in their mouths as a form of penance. Harper herself has shown a flagrant disregard for Carol's authority, but has refused to properly atone. In the scene that follows, she has just left a meeting with Carol, where she made it clear she views the new punishments as cruel and unhealthy. Convinced things are going bad, Harper is now on her way to see John to seek his advice and to warn him of the danger growing around them. Harper followed a barely discernible path beneath an obscure sky. Whichever way she turned her face, snow blew into it. The wind gusted. A tree cracked. Boards wobbled and flexed underfoot, requiring her to proceed slowly to keep her balance. When the house of the Black Star was out of sight behind her, she held up in the frozen, pine-scented dark. In another 200 steps, she would cross the trail that wound down through the trees to the shingle and the dock. She could be across the water to the fireman's island in 10 minutes, tell him what Carol had decided, warn him that... A child ran through the pines to her right, a flickering shadow shape, and she turned her head to look and saw that it wasn't a child at all, only a skein of snow fleeing through the trees. Whack! A snowball hit her in the side of her head, but she didn't know it until she had gone another 2 steps. It took that long to register. She was not aware of reeling to one side or her right knee giving out under her until she found herself kneeling in the snow. Harper saw a blur of motion from the corner of her eye and raised an elbow in time to block the next snowball. The impact deadened her arm. A ringing shock jolted from elbow to hand. The snowball shattered the moment it struck her. The speckled white stone that had been packed in its center rolled out onto the snow in front of her. Girl shapes jumped from behind trees on either side of her, breathless with laughter. Harper thought she saw a snowball sailing at her stomach and dropped her arms to cover it, and it hit the side of her neck instead, a sharp sting, followed by numbness. they circled. The water in her eyes wanted to turn to ice, freeze there. The faces surrounding her were stiff and white and inexpressive, as if she were being attacked by department store mannequins. One of them charged at her back and shoved her. She toppled onto her side. "Please be careful," she said. "I'm pregnant. I'm not fighting you." "Whitewash! Whitewash!" sang someone who sounded horribly like 11-year-old Emily Waterman. Someone grabbed her hair in one gloved hand, picked up a fistful of snow in the other, and scrubbed her face with it. A girl shrieked with laughter. When Harper blinked away the snow, Tyrion Lannister from Game of Thrones was crouched before her. He looked at her with a blank-eyed incredulity, a cheap plastic mask. It was a girl behind that mask, held out a hand, palm up. A flat white stone rested in it. "Eat it," came the voice from behind the mask. "Eat it, bitch. Make her eat it," another girl in another mask said. They were all masked. "Eat it, eat it, eat it," girls chanted. Harper was on her side in the snow, one arm covering the ripe swell of her belly, the other arm trapped under her body. The girl holding her hair yanked. Then she yanked harder. Harper opened her mouth and held it open like a child letting a doctor look at her tonsils. Tyrion Lannister forced in the stone, a cool, flat weight. There was a sound like someone ripping a bedsheet in half. The hand clutching her hair yanked, pulling Harper's chin up, forcing her head back. Another hand slapped her in the mouth, hard. A thumb moved back and forth, pressing the strip of duct tape flat across her lips. "Half an hour," said the girl who had her by the hair. "It stays in for half an hour. Now get up. Get on your knees." Harper was lifted onto her knees. The girls pulled her arms behind her, and there was another ripping sound, while one of them tore off a fresh length of duct tape and bound her wrists together.
"Maybe,"
Harper said, meaning be careful of the baby. She had no idea if anyone understood her. Two girls danced together, holding hands, twisting and spinning each other. One wore an Obama mask, the other a Donald Trump face. Flashlights played across the pines, a swarm of bright gold lights. Harper had to look again before she realized none of the girls were holding flashlights. It was the girls themselves, leaping about, laughing, kicking snow at her. They were lit up, like in church when they sang together. They shone for each other, their dragon scale throbbing, intense enough to cast a brightness from under their jackets, up around their open collars. So, there were other ways to enter the exalted state of the bright then. A chorus or a firing squad, either would serve to satisfy the scale.
You're listening to a special edition of Word of Mouth with Joe Hill, recorded live at the Music Hall for writers on a New England stage.
Harper heard the snicker-snack of scissors. Her gold hair began to fall in the snow.
"Ha ha, ha ha,"
said the smallest of her attackers, the girl she was sure was Emily Waterman.
"Cut it off! Cut it all off!"
Her voice was a drunken bray. The wind sighed reluctantly, like a lover who realizes it's time to go. Her hair fell around her while the scissors went snickety-snack. The girl who had been clipping her hair said, "Isn't it sexy, the way the scissors sound?" She opened and closed them next to Harper's ear. "Gives me shivers. I like cutting your hair so much, I'm sorry there's not more of it. I'm sorry I have to stop. Maybe next time I'll cut something else. You need to decide if you're with us or against us. If you're going to shine with us or not shine at all. You want my medical advice, nurse? I prescribe a change in your b***y attitude." Harper thought there was a chance that soon one of them would haul back and kick her belly like a football, just for the fun of it. They didn't know what they were doing anymore. Maybe they had already gone much further than they had intended. Maybe they had just meant to pelt her with snowballs and run. They had forgotten who they were. They had forgotten their own names, the voices of their mothers, the faces of their fathers. She thought it was very possible they would kill her here in the snow without meaning to, use that pair of scissors to open her throat. When you were in the bright, everything felt good. Everything felt right. You didn't walk, you danced. The world pulsed with secret song, and you were the star of your own Technicolor musical. The blood leaping from her carotid artery would be as beautiful to them as a sparkler throwing a burning red shower of phosphorus. The girls who had been standing behind her all this time pushed her onto her side in the snow. A bubble of some powerful, dangerous emotion quivered inside her, and Harper remained very still so it would not burst. She did not want to find out what it was, whether it was grief, terror, or, worst of all, surrender. Each of the girls took turns dancing up to her and kicking snow in her face, and Harper closed her eyes. The girls stood over her, whispering. Harper couldn't bear to look at them, to see that circle of masked faces gathered around her. They talked on and on in soft, hissing, unintelligible voices. Harper shivered violently. Her jeans were soaked, and her wrists hurt, and her face was raw and burnt from all the snow that had been thrown in it. At last she opened her eyes at a squint. The whispering continued, but the girls were gone. The only thing talking was the wind shushing the pines. She wriggled and twisted her wrists. The tape was on her gloves, not her skin, and in a while she was able to squirm one hand free. Harper pulled off the other glove and tossed them both aside, still stuck together with duct tape. She did not hesitate, did not give herself time to think, but found the edge of the duct tape over her mouth and ripped it off. She tore away some of her upper lip with it. Harper spat the stone into the snow. It was pink with blood. She got so lightheaded when she stood up, she had to put a hand against a pine to steady herself. She made her way from trunk to trunk like a wobbly toddler taking her first steps and using the furniture to steady herself. She found the turning to the waterfront and started down the hill. The thought was in her to get to the fireman, tell him what had happened to her, what was happening to camp. Maybe, even now, it was not too late to pull things back on course, to make Camp Wyndham well again. She got perhaps 12 steps when someone called out to her. "Nurse Willows," Nelson Heinrich shouted. "Where are you going? The path to the infirmary is up here." He stood on the boards with Jamie close. Jamie was dressed in the same clothes she had been wearing the last time Harper saw her, the blaze orange snow pants and the puffy slate-colored parka. The only thing different was that she had taken off the Tyrion Lannister mask. "That snow is up to your neck. Why don't you come back here before you're buried alive?" Nelson's face was scrubbed red from the cold, and he grinned to show his two front teeth. Harper's breath steamed. When she licked her upper lip, she tasted blood. It took her almost 5 minutes to trudge the 20 steps back to the boards, wading waist-deep in the snow, powder getting inside her boots. "Jamie and I were just off to relieve the lookouts at Mother Carol's. Good thing we showed up when we did. You were all turned around." He reached out with both hands to help her up onto the planks. Nelson frowned, but his eyes were gay with amusement. "But look at all these tracks. We have rules, you know. No stepping off the paths. What if a hunter wandered by and saw all the tracks you've made? By God, if we were discovered, they'd ship us all off to Concord. If they didn't just shoot us here. Wandering puts the whole camp in peril. Mr. Patchett and Mother Carol have been very clear about that. 1 hour with a stone should remind you of your responsibilities." Jamie Close stepped around him, holding out a white stone in her palm. She grinned to show a chipped tooth. Harper took the rock and obediently put it in her mouth. I wish I could say that good things happened to Harper afterwards, but actually it only gets worse from there.
"You're out of touch, my baby. My fault just got a baby.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Joe Hill, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the very setting for his new novel, The Fireman. Except in the novel, Portsmouth is not the picturesque seaside community we know today, but a town reduced to smoldering ash.
The town is all over the book. North Church is in the book. I burned Portsmouth Hospital to the ground. Sorry about that.
In the novel, those infected with the mysterious dragon scale spore spontaneously burst into flame. The contagion twists a peaceful community into a violent, punitive mob. Neighbors turn against neighbors, husbands against wives. It's a scenario that Joe Hill has shown us before. In his novel, Horns, a grisly murder transforms citizens of another Granite State village into today's version of pitchfork-wielding vigilantes. Not exactly the quaint New England portraits we are used to. So I asked Joe Hill if he mistrusts the people in small New Hampshire towns.
No, I write what I know in the sense of I feel like I can make stuff up. I can write a story about a ghost or a vampire or a devil or a runaway pathogen that causes people to spontaneously combust. I can sell a crazy, fantastic idea, but I need to ground it in something that I know intimately. And I know life in New England. I know what the roads are like. I know what jobs are like here. I know what the weather is like. I have a sense for how people live their day-to-day lives. I remember years ago, I was invited to write a story about Van Helsing for a collection. And for me, the hardest part of writing that story was figuring out how I'd get Van Helsing to New England. Because I couldn't leave him there in old England. I would have had him running around in the fog saying, "God save the Queen," or something dreadful like that. So this is what I know and how I know to ground a story.
And dragon scale, tell us more about it. One of the characters calls it the most sexy pathogen ever. How fully formed was it in your mind when you started writing this book?
You know, when I came out here earlier, I said thanks to a bunch of people. One person I forgot to thank who is here tonight is my mother, Tabitha King, a terrific American novelist. And my mother is an amateur mycologist, and she knows a lot about spores and fungal infection and mushrooms, and she goes out in the woods and she picks mushrooms and she brings them back and she cooks them in an omelet, and she hasn't killed anyone yet. And so in The Fireman, we have this runaway pathogen, this spore called dragon scale, and it gets on you, and it's very beautiful. It looks like a delicate tattoo, black lines with gold speckling in it. And it's beautiful, but when you stress out, when you feel anxiety, you start to smoke. And if you can't control your fear, you burst into flames and you die of spontaneous combustion. The crazy thing is, as improbable as it sounds, most of what the dragon scale can do can actually be found somewhere in mycology. Almost every single aspect of it exists to one degree or another. And that was a very conscious choice to do something that was grounded in science after writing several supernatural novels that were completely about the fantastic. And for my research, I mind my mother.
Well, Harper Willows Grayson, who is the school nurse,
yeah,
who is the protagonist of this novel mostly, she uses Mary Poppins as a role model. She's plucky, she's very smart, but sort of like in Nosferatu, Vic McQueen, you know, it's a really strong female protagonist. And I'm wondering how you got that female protagonist gene. You're probably your mother again?
Well, you know, my mother comes from a large family and has many sisters. And I did grow up, you know, for me, what was terrific was sitting under the dining room table when I was 7 or 8. And my mother is from the Spruce family. And when the Spruces got a couple glasses of wine in them and slipped into some fairly salty talk about politics and Maine and work and relationships, that was always really exciting to listen to as a little kid. You know, you felt like you were getting the real deal. So some of that is, I think some of that is directly a result of coming from the Spruce family, which is really, was always really a matriarchy. You know, as a side note, every time I see a Trump rally on TV, I think about a thing that my grandmother, Sarah Jane, said that always stuck with me. She said, "It's one thing to be ignorant, and it's another thing to be proud of it."
Well, I'm thinking, we were talking about this earlier today with my producers, we were saying that this isn't really a post-apocalyptic novel. It's like a mid-apocalyptic novel.
Yeah.
They're kind of in the apocalypse. And it's interesting that women are often the protagonists in those kind of novels. What does that mean? Why do you think that you gravitated toward that for this?
I don't know if I even agree with the question, because certainly some stories like The Road, which is post-apocalyptic, is kind of a manly man story. It's like, I mean, were there, I don't know if there was a single female in the whole book. If there's a lot of female characters in The Firemen, that's partially a reaction to the superhero movies that have been out just lately. There's been this whole rash of tremendous superhero films going up to all the way the recent one, Captain America Civil War. But they do have their flaws, and one of them is the utter lack of female characters. There's this single female superhero, right? Black Widow. And Black Widow, she's like the only woman in the whole thing, and she has to be everyone's love interest, and she has to represent every woman in the world, and that's just untenable. That just doesn't make a character. So I did look at The Firemen as this big science fiction action kind of superhero story, because The Firemen is kind of a superhero. He's sort of 50% The Human Torch, 50% Charlie McGee from Firestarter. But the secret of the book is that almost all the big roles are played by women. It's the title itself is a bait and switch. It's called The Fireman, but it's really Harper's story. It's her foot on the gas pedal. It's her decisions that make the action happen. And she's surrounded by a lot of interesting female characters. Her closest ally is Renee Gilmanton. She contends with a frenemy, a teenage girl named Allie, who is kind of punk rock. And maybe the most sinister character in the book is Mother Carol, who is this neurotic paranoid who rules over Camp Wyndham with an iron grip.
You're listening to a special edition of Word of Mouth. It's my conversation with Joe Hill, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage.
Well, you give us a lot of pop culture references in the book, like Glenn Beck immolates on television.
Oh, poor Glenn.
J.K. Rowling is executed publicly for helping out the infected.
She's helped the infected, secretly used her wealth and her influence to help many of the infected, and then she's rounded up, and in front of the firing squad, she refuses to apologize for a single adverb.
George Clooney burns on a do-gooder mission.
That hit my mom hard.
Yeah. It wasn't easy for me to take either. So what are you doing here, placing us in the now?
You know, it is a science fiction novel, and all science fiction novels are not really about the future. They're always about what's happening now. It doesn't matter if the story is set in, you know, the 25th century. The good ones are always about us here now. And in the same way I write about New England, you know, we're all swimming in the pop culture. You know, it's the bread and butter of our lives. And apocalyptic scenarios, I mean, we've had this. We've had Walking Dead on TV for 6 years. We've had The Road. We've had all the, you know, Dawn of the Dead. And I think it's impossible to write an apocalyptic story without reflecting upon the stories and the stuff that's around us. I mean, I'd add, you know, someone said the most unrealistic thing about any zombie movie at this point is the idea that people wouldn't know what the zombies were. You know, that they wouldn't have a plan. We've had so much of them, we'd be like, oh, it's happening. Okay.
You also have a very powerful talk radio host who's sort of
stirring
things
up. There's a morning shock jock, maybe right-wing type guy who comes in the story. And his name is the Marlboro Man, and he's sort of the voice of America's bro dudes. He's a fairly nasty piece of work, but he was also sort of ugly fun to write about. You know, this is a guy who's probably the great experience of his life was like seeing Ted Nugent in concert.
Well, tell me about that, the ugly fun of writing these nasty characters. What kind of headspace do you have to be in, or do you just, they just come?
I always try to bring a sense of humor to it. No matter how bad they are, I always try to find some way to have fun with them. Maybe to get over sort of the bleak nature of the acts they decide to do. The Marlboro Man heads a crew, a cremation crew, and they're cruising New England looking for people who are infected. Because one thing they know is if you shoot someone who's infected, they won't spontaneously combust and they won't burn down your neighborhood. So there's not much incentive to treat the sick with mercy. That actually speaks to a larger issue I wanted to explore in the story. You know, I love Walking Dead. I love zombie apocalypse stories. But what are these stories really about? These stories are about not wanting the infected near you, about people who are different than you and seeing them as the enemy. It would be better if we could build a wall to keep them out, or if we could somehow ban all of those people from coming to the nation. I'm just speaking generally. I don't have any specific political platform in mind. But The Walking Dead is really about, like, ooh, they're infected. It would be better if they just died. I don't want them to touch me. And as much as I love those stories, I would prefer to write a story that takes up for the sick, where the heroes are the people who are contaminated. And I also think that's more exciting because they're the underdogs.
Well, it is amazing that you sort of, I don't know, put everybody in this kind of pressure cooker, right? You know, in this universe where, as one character says, you know, how do you punish somebody who's already on death row? You know, how do you create a society when everybody's afraid?
Apocalyptic fiction is very hot right now, no pun intended. But that's not actually all that new. There have been a lot of apocalypse stories going back to I Am Legend by Richard Matheson and War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells and the Book of Revelation. And so we've been imagining the end for a long time, and I think that's because everyone will face a personal apocalypse at some point because you'll die, and then that will be the end of the world for you. And sooner or later, every generation that has walked on Earth will be completely wiped out and completely gone, and that will be the apocalypse for them. This is getting really cheery, right, guys? But when we write a story about the end of the world, it's a fun, sort of playful way to explore what actually happens, which is that people have their lives, generations have their historical moment, and then the slate is wiped clean and we go on.
Well, we also get to see sort of flip sides of community, right?
Yeah.
That community, in some ways, at Camp Wyndham is a thing that connects people. It's a thing that protects people. But you also point out that you have bonding over extermination crews going out and killing people at the same time. So what are you working out there?
Right, and Camp Wyndham is also, at first, when Harper arrives there, it's a good place where people sing together and they share and there's empathy and it's fun and it's this very supportive environment. But as the pressure builds around them, as some key figures fall by the wayside, it becomes a paranoid, toxic place where no one is really safe and everyone is afraid. And I think I was thinking about social media. There are lots of good things about Twitter or Facebook or other forms of social connection in the online world. There's community, there's laughs, there's the chance to share these delicious moments like geeking out over the new Star Wars film. But then there's the other side of social media. You know, you have a community of friends where you're sharing good stuff, but then there's other communities like a community of people that gets off on harassing women online and they'll find some woman who dared to have an opinion and then they'll circle and pile on, and it's sort of gross and creepy. There's the practice of online shaming, which is very popular. And, you know, the truth is, there, if you want to be outraged, there is a lot of things to be outraged about in the world. There are a lot of people who are begging to be shamed. But for myself, I don't like the way that makes me feel. I don't really want to be part of a group piling on, even if someone is begging for it. And I also don't want to spend all day being outraged. And so the constant bubble of outrage online, I don't think is terribly healthy. So I did want to explore the way community can build a person up and can just as easily tear a person down.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Joe Hill, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Joe Hill made his name as the best-selling author of Horns, Nosferatu, and most recently, The Fireman, which we talked about before the break. Despite using that nom de plume, Joe Hill is the son of Stephen King, a fact he successfully kept hidden in the early days of his writing career. His mother is the novelist Tabitha King. His brother Owen is also a writer, who told a reporter that Joe insisted on writing 2 hours a day including weekends and holidays, at the age of 8. I asked Joe Hill about that discipline and what it was like growing up in such a literary household.
You know, I would come home from school and my dad would be in his office clattering away at his word processor. And my mom had this tomato-colored electric typewriter that always seemed to be on the edge of having a seizure. It would rattle furiously, and she'd be in there making something up. And so by the time I was 12, I just kind of thought that's what you did, is you spent an hour or two by yourself, and you made stuff up, and sooner or later, someone would pay you lots of money for it. Which turned out to be true.
So what was it like? I mean, what were bedtime stories like in the King family?
Jay Leno had this joke that I've never forgotten, where he said, Stephen King says to the kids, come on, kids, it's time for a bedtime story. And the kids all go, no, no. The bedtime stories were great. No one tells better bedtime stories than my dad. And he knew what we liked, which was superheroes, Spider-Man. And he would always tell it, they weren't scary stories, but they were horrifying. There's a difference. He would tell these Spider-Man stories, and he knew that humiliation was worse than death. So, like, Spider-Man would be fighting Doc Ock, but he'd also have diarrhea. And mid-fight, he'd get punched in the stomach and his bowels would let go. And the whole back of his suit would balloon out with this horrifying squish. And as kids, you just wanted to melt at the horror of it. You just felt like this is nothing has ever happened to Spider-Man to even begin compete with the horror of this moment.
So did he encourage you to make up stories too? I mean, were you part of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's the dinner time conversation was always literary conversation. We were always talking about the books we read, characters we liked. It sounds very 19th century, but after dinner, instead of watching TV, we would go into the living room together and pass a book around and read to each other. Oh. And that's how I first read The Chronicles of Narnia, and how I read some of the early work of H.P. Lovecraft, and Lawrence Block, a great American crime writer, and that was all stuff we discovered together as a family.
But you did go to great lengths to conceal your pedigree, let's put it that way. Changing your name to Joe Hill?
Well, my name is already Joe Hill.
It's Joe Hillstrom?
It's Joseph Hillstrom King, and I decided to publish as Joe Hill instead of picking up, I considered some pen names, but in the end I thought, well, Joe Hill makes the most sense because it would be easy to cash the checks.
So why? I mean, why did that matter to you so much?
So I'm a pretty insecure guy, and when I was 18, 19, I began to worry about publishing as Joseph King because I had a fear it would invite a publisher to accept mediocre work and publish it because they saw a chance to make a quick buck in the last name. And I didn't want that, and I needed to know when I sold a story that I sold it for the right reasons, because it was really good and an editor loved it and wanted to go forward with it. So I dropped the last name, and I was able to keep my identity a secret for about a decade. And that was long enough to collect a lot of rejection letters and also publish some short stories and build my craft. And I had my big breakthrough with Spider-Man, where I did my 11-page Spider-Man story. Spider-Man did not get diarrhea, which just goes to show that I'm like a quarter of the writer my dad is. You know, I missed a golden opportunity.
When the cat was let out of the bag, however, you know, you've been for some time established as your own writer. I mean, your fans come to you as Joe Hill fans, and you're a New York Times bestselling writer. And do you ever get that urge to throw that identity all away and begin anew? I mean, do you feel at all constrained by being Joe Hill?
Oh, not at all. No, I mean, not even a little. You know, I still think that to a degree the pen name works, that even now a lot of people know, but a lot of people don't know. It's ridiculous to think people sit at home Googling me, you know? Most people don't care. And they'll wander into a bookstore with a few minutes to kill, you know? Maybe they're there to buy a Mother's Day gift or something, and they decide to get a little something-something for themselves, and they'll see Nosferatu or Heart-Shaped Box and pick it up and say, oh, this looks good, and go home and read it and have a good time, and then they Google me. And I always feel like, oh, it's great. It's great when I got a reader who didn't know. It's okay when I got a reader who did know. but it's still sort of satisfying when I capture another reader who is, you know, unwitting.
Well, still, you know, coming into your own obviously has not been easy. I read about after the heart-shaped box that you went through a really tough time.
Yeah.
You got divorced. You had a breakdown, which you've since talked about publicly. How did you know when you needed help?
So I did have, I mean, it's sort of one of these depressing cliches, you know? It's like someone has a big success and gets all their daydreams and then everything falls apart. And I hate cliche. Like, that's just, you learn to avoid that when as a writer. I have a line in the book where I say about one character that Ben Patchett loves cliches so much that he leaves no stone unturned. But I did have this kind of collapse after Heart-Shaped Box came out. I felt very depressed, and I had always struggled with a certain degree of paranoia, but never, it was always manageable. It always stayed in its box, and this time it kind of exploded from the box, and it was very hard to control. I remember when I went on tour for Horns, which was a very, very hard book to write because I was such an unhappy person when I wrote it, and I remember going on tour for it, and I'd be on at the events, but after the events, I'd be tearing apart my hotel room looking for fiber optic cameras because I was convinced someone was spying on me, and my dad was the one person I could talk to. I'd call him every night with my latest set of paranoid fascinations. He's very patient about listening to it, but at one point he said, you know, Joe, it might help to have someone professional to talk to about some of these ideas. I had anxious thoughts and paranoid thoughts earlier. I had resisted the idea of talking to a therapist or a doctor about it. I didn't want to get on a medicine, on a pill, because I was afraid it would cut my creativity.
Yeah, where you kind of have that cultural thrall, right? That, you know, the crazy artist, that's what drives you.
It turned out that actually being a paranoid asshat was cutting into my creativity, and that getting on the pill and getting into therapy made it easier to write. But it didn't matter if I ever wrote again. At a certain point, I had three boys, and I realized I needed to be sane and balanced for them.
You're listening to a special edition of Word of Mouth. It's my conversation with Joe Hill, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage.
Here's a question from the audience. Nearly every author will admit to experiencing writer's block from time to time. Do you have any sure method that you use to stave off the block and get the juices flowing again?
I think writer's block is a very artificial condition. And usually what it comes down to is your subconscious presents you with subjects you want to explore. And you have decided you're not going to explore that subject. Your subconscious wants you to write about masturbation. And you're like, oh my God, I am not going to write that story about masturbation. What if my mom reads it? And so you say, I'm not going to write that. I'm going to write some other story. But then that story won't come because your subconscious has decided to take its baseball and go home. It's like, we're either writing what I want or we're not writing anything at all. And so you have to get over it, and you have to write the wanking story. And the truth is, your mom already knew. She already knew all about it. She's not going to be stunned. She'll be glad you're finally addressing it.
Well, your dialogue is so good. You mentioned Renee Gilmanton, who's her best friend. She's a woman in her 40s, African-American, and then there's this other character who is as white-bread, salt-of-the-earth Yankee as you can possibly get.
Yeah, Don Lewiston.
Yeah. So how do you do dialogue? Are you sort of playing it out in your head?
Yeah, it takes me about 3 years to write a book, and I'm trying to get faster, and I think I am getting faster. And I always think the first 18 months is a matter of finding the characters' voices. So I'm really just working on the first third of the book for the first 18 months. And I'm playing all these scenes that almost inevitably don't make it into the finished novel, but just so I can get the characters talking to each other and seeing how they think and how they solve puzzles and what they do when they're in a tight spot. Then the rest of the book I'm usually able to write in about 6 months, because by then I know who the characters are, how they talk to each other, how they think about themselves and the world. And whenever I place them in a situation, it's easy to see what they would do. And so then I just follow them.
So when an idea is germinating for you, you know, since you have written short stories, graphic novels, novels, how do you figure out which format to use? I was thinking sort of Dragon Scale would look beautiful in a graphic novel or a comic book.
Well, it's a novel if it gets to be too long to be a short story. So when I get to page 50, it's starting to look like a novel. and it's a comic book if I'm seeing the story in panels. Sometimes I'll be working on a story and I will just naturally see it in panels. The comic book I spent the most time on, I spent 6 years writing a comic book called Lock and Key. Thanks. That started, so I did this Spider-Man story for Marvel, and that started as a pitch for Marvel Comics because I wanted to do more. And Marvel turned it down, DC turned it down, and some other people turned it down, and some other pitches. I had this one pitch called Baby Hulk because I just had a toddler, and I always thought toddlers would be sweet and stuff and that they would be fun, but boy, they get mad. They get so angry. And, you know, my toddler picked up a plastic truck and was, and threw it. And I thought, what if it was a real truck? And so I wrote this pitch for Baby Hulk, and I guess Marvel thought that was messed up, and they're like, no. But so I had this idea for a story about a house filled with magic keys, and every key would unlock a different door and activate a different supernatural power. And even after the idea had been turned around, you know, I'd be out driving at 11 in the evening to go buy diapers, and I would just have an idea for a new key. And I think that's cool. And that idea started as a comic book thing, so I always saw it in terms of panels.
How do you approach writing a graphic novel differently than a prose novel?
I figure out what artist I'm working with, and usually it's one of my closest friends, Gabriel Rodriguez, who was my co-collaborator on Lock and Key. And
love him.
Yeah, clap. You know, my terror, so I'm up here, so you wonder what, you know, a guy who writes scary stuff is scared of. Here's what I'm scared of, okay? Just a little segue. You know, so I'm sitting up here, and I think, what if I say something that I think is cool and no one claps? And I turn into Jeb, and I'm like... Please clap. You know, that's what you just... And then I can never have that moment back. It'll be like on YouTube and stuff and, you know, ugh. What was the question? What were we talking about?
How do you approach writing a graphic novel differently?
How did I get to the please clap thing? Gabriel
Rodriguez.
So when I'm writing a comic script, what I think about is what would Gabe love to draw? So when I'm tackling any sequence, I'm always thinking about what would be the most fun and or the hardest thing for him to draw here. The harder, the better, you know? And he is doing so. I did, in the 1980s, there was a TV show called Tales from the Dark Side. And great, it was my generation's Outer Limits, Twilight Zone, great show. I was hired to relaunch it. And my reboot of Tales from the Dark Side went on. It's now entering its second hit season in my imagination. In real life, CBS decided not to produce it. They filmed the first episode. It tested great. Everyone loved it. And they didn't do it. But my comic publisher, IDW, said, if you don't want it, we do. And they got the rights to the screenplays. And they got Gabriel Rodriguez to draw them. And so now people are going to get a taste of what the TV show would have been because we're going to do Tales from the Dark Side as a comic.
Whoa! Let's see. You know, I was thinking about working with Gabriel Rodriguez. That's a very collaborative kind of thing. So what was it like to go from that to, I would say, the relatively solitary life of a novelist?
Yeah. You know, the thing about writing novels or short stories is it's lonely, isolating work. I actually can't see the audience because the light is in my face, and that's how I like it, you know, that I feel so comfortable when I'm essentially almost alone. So the thing which is great about comic books is you have this band. It's like being in the Stones, you know. You've got, you know, Gabe is like Keith Richards, only better looking and not, like, all weird. And you know, I felt like I was the drummer and the colorist is like the keyboard guy, and it was so much fun. It was almost too much fun, and it's easy, and strangely that's kind of an argument not to do too much in comics. You know, writing novels and short stories is hard and frustrating, but I think that that's the work that develops you. And I want to keep those skills sharp as well. And when you finish a novel or a short story, there's a unique satisfaction in that.
Well, in this novel, even Mary Poppins singing a spoonful of sugar becomes somehow tinged. It becomes creepified.
With the sinister, yeah.
and I was just like in Nosferatu, you know, the Christmas land, the amusement park becomes creepified.
Lon Chaney had this great quote where he said, "There's nothing funny about a clown at midnight."
But is that your aim, to poison our cheery views with something darker?
I always think the juxtaposition of something sweet and innocent, like an ice cream truck, or Christmas, if you juxtapose that with something terrible, there's a frisson there which creates chills, which creates fear. And I did play around with, so Harper loves the musicals of the 1950s and the 1960s. She's this tremendously happy, optimistic, good-humored person. And she's the kind of person who probably sings too loud in the shower. And it was sort of satisfying to have this plague pouring across the nation, destroying everything, which becomes the unstoppable force crashing into the immovable object of Harper's optimism. And I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition. To create the character, I did watch a number of very old Disney musicals, which is proof that I'll suffer anything for you people.
She's a person who gives unflinchingly. I mean, she doesn't even think about it. Even to her enemies, she's like, if someone's hurt, I'm going to help them. But there's this really interesting moral dilemma that she has in the book, right? That she's pregnant.
Yeah.
She realizes that she's walking around carrying this spore and carrying this baby. I think she says it's something like, it's like a loaded gun that a kid could find. I mean, she could kill somebody with that.
Yeah.
It is such an interesting thing that she's, you know, she's doing this not for the self, but for the future. So have you written the hopeful apocalyptic book?
It's more like, it is really the sunny look at the end of the world. You know, that was how I viewed it. I read Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which I love, and I love Cormac McCarthy, and I mean, he's 10 times the writer that I am. But there's this scene in The Road where these degenerates are frying a baby on a spit over a campfire. And I know it's the most horrifying scene in the book, but isn't it also sort of funny? Is it wrong to think that? You know, because it's so bad. It's so awful. And one of the things I wanted to say in the book, I wanted to show some people who have a sense of humor and a sense of empathy, a basic core sense of decency. I believe that humor and empathy are not luxuries that we would cast aside when times get tough, and then we'd be animals chewing each other's throats out for the last can of Spam. You know, I think that humanity is, humans are affectionate little monkeys, and that we have to love and root for each other. And, you know, when the towers fell, there were people running up the staircase to see who else they could help. If you don't show humanity's decency, it's hard to see why anyone would care if we survived the apocalypse. You know, if we're really if we're going to be down roasting babies on a spit over a campfire, maybe it's time for the cockroaches to have their turn.
Ladies and gentlemen, please clap for Joe Hill.
Hey, thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks so much.
A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
Joe Hill there, the best-selling author of comic books, short stories, and novels. His latest is called The Fireman. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. The Music Hall producer and communication director is Margaret Talcott. NHPR's broadcast producer is Taylor Quimby. NHPR's digital producer, Sarah Plord. The Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. Live sound and recording and mixing engineer is Ian Martin. Musical director and band are Bob Lord and Dreadnought. Photos from this event are posted at Clear Eye Photo. And you can see photos and listen to more author interviews from the Writers on a New England Stage series and hear more about Joe Hill's writing process from the 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcast. You'll find both at nhpr.org. Just look for the series option from the drop-down menu at the top of the screen. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.